You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, 45 states and Washington, D.C. are reporting widespread flu activity. What can the nation do to stay safe over the holidays? 1A's series Vaccination Nation returns today to answer your questions. That's today at 6. Now, a new study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention looks at the impact of alcohol on mortality in the United States. The annual death toll was in the range of 140,000. That comes from data before the COVID-19 pandemic when alcohol consumption went up. Two-thirds of those deaths are among working-age Americans between the ages of 20 and 64. That accounts for one out of every eight deaths in that age range. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is alcohol abuse an issue that has affected you or someone close to you at your workplace and your family? How are you dealing with yourself? Do you have questions about the public health surrounding alcohol, what we could do to dial down this problem? Do you have thoughts on alcohol culture in the United States and here in Wisconsin in particular? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Patrick Remington is a professor emeritus in the Department of Population Health Sciences at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He's director of the UW-Madison Preventive Medicine Residency Program. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back. Thanks.
This is a trend, sadly, that you've been watching for quite some time now. These numbers, this is 2015 to 2019 data crunched here, confirm a lot of what we were seeing even before the pandemic, right?
Well, it does. We actually did a study very similar to this more than 20 years ago in Wisconsin, and the results were very similar. In that study, about 5% of all deaths in all ages were related to alcohol. And we don't like to say necessarily abuse, because sometimes a moderate alcohol consumption can increase the risk of a chronic disease, for example. And if many people are drinking alcohol moderately, then you can actually see a lot of disease and death related to what one might call normal use or not abuse of alcohol.
And this working age range, one in eight deaths from 20 to 64, if you crunch it down to 20 and 34, I think it was one in four deaths. So these are ages that are less prone to die of some other causes. But what does that say to you, these numbers, when it comes to people in that 20 to 64 age range?
Well, it's a good point. I had always thought about all ages and that sort of one in 20 or 5% of deaths. But when you begin to narrow the age group to 20 to 64, working age, typical working age population, that percentage goes up to about 13%, even more in men. Men tend to drink more heavily and therefore have a higher proportion of disease caused by alcohol use. And then, as you point out, when you get to the ages of 20 to 40, for example, it's even a higher percentage. But again, as you mentioned, fortunately, relatively few people die under the age of 40. So although there are fewer deaths, more of them are due to alcohol, and most of them are due to what we call the acute effects, injuries related to motor vehicle crashes, even homicides and suicides. Alcohol contributes to those deaths. When you study a homicide, you find that many times the perpetrator or the victim have high blood alcohol levels, and therefore we posit that alcohol contributed to that event.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington, professor emeritus at the Department of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison, looking at the latest CDC numbers on death related to alcohol. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions? Do you have solutions? Do you have thoughts on our public health approach to alcohol and the damage it can do? You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, or experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Remington, as you mentioned, there are different things that go from alcohol to mortality. I want to talk about a few different ones and get into some possible public health approaches. One that we've talked about in the past is kind of a straight line from alcohol consumption to health problems that cause death. This is on my mind actually a lot in the last couple of years in my other life. I'm in the music community. There's a lot of drinking there. A couple of years ago, we lost a collaborator of mine in Wisconsin Rapids who died of dementia, an early dementia caused by alcohol. Just got word this week that a former bandmate lost his wife. Again, physical damage caused by chronic drinking. Can you talk about that as a cause of death, that excessive ongoing drinking, and what we can do to try to help people out of that?
Well, there's no question that what we call chronic heavy drinking is bad for your health. The liver is the organ most affected by this. And the leading causes of death in this study were liver disease, alcoholic liver disease, cirrhosis. And so that's the organ that really suffers the most with heavy alcohol consumption. And what does that mean, heavy alcohol consumption? Mm-hmm. Well, most people say that having more than two drinks a day, three or four or five drinks every day for many years is heavy alcohol use. That might not constitute problem drinking because people may be able to function perfectly in society. So we wouldn't call that an alcoholic drinking pattern, but it is certainly bad for health. And these chronic diseases do accumulate, and there aren't very good treatments for the alcohol-induced liver disease, for example, heart disease, hypertension risk increases. And there are a half a dozen or more cancers that are related to heavy alcohol use. So yes, heavy alcohol use, alcohol is a poison. And when taken in excess, it definitely affects the health and shortens one's life.
From a public health perspective, what do you see as the most effective means of outreach, prevention, to get the message out to people that that is a dangerous habit to have, and then to help them kick that habit?
Well, I think there are two approaches. One is individually. Everybody obviously needs to assess their own drinking behavior. Even more recently, a study just published last spring looked at light drinking. And we used to think that light drinking actually was good for your heart, a drink or maybe two a day. But the most recent research suggests that that's not, in fact, mm-hmm. the case. There's very little risk with a drink or so a day that has been shown in this research. But the more you drink, the greater the risk is. And so I think individually, we all have to self-monitor and think about our own risk. But the second area is what we can do as a community. For example, studies have shown that when you raise the tax on a product, fewer people consume that product. And so states and communities that have raised the excise tax on alcohol see less consumption. And that's been an approach that's been used widely, not just with alcohol, but with cigarettes, for example. The other issue is alcohol density. The more places that sell alcohol, the more hours, the higher the drinking patterns are. So that those are population-based or public health approaches that attempt to improve the health of everybody, not just individuals who have problem drinking.
And then, so I gave the example of chronic, long-term heavy drinking. Now, how about that acute instance? And we've talked about this before, too. Maybe it's binge drinking or somebody drinking more than they're used to. And as you mentioned, that could be connected to a homicide, a car crash, a fall, especially for seniors. How do we tackle that side of the problem?
Again, that's a very tough problem because those individuals who decide to drink, the term is binge drinking, where you drink maybe four or five drinks on one occasion, and then go out and drive a car or operate machinery or just fall. Those events are very predictable. We know from lots of research that people get impaired from even moderate drinking, and certainly binge drinking leads to an increase in risk. And so we've addressed this problem by having stiffer drunk driving laws and things like have a friend drive, where you may continue to drink, but you've decided to designate a driver in your group. So there are approaches, one of which is to avoid binge drinking, but the other is to avoid the activity that is dangerous when you've been binge drinking. And both of those have been successful. We've seen some evidence that car crashes related to alcohol use have decreased, but they're certainly not where they need to be. And there's a lot of more progress that could be made.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Population Health Sciences and Director of the UW-Madison Preventive Medicine Residency Program, looking at the latest CDC numbers on deaths linked to alcohol in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We know these problems have been on the rise pre-pandemic. How did the pandemic impact alcohol use among you, your circle of family and friends? Do you see chronic heavy drinking in your community? Are there changes you think we need to make in our culture here in Wisconsin surrounding alcohol? Join in with your thoughts, questions, or experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison, Director of the UW-Madison Preventive Medicine Residency Program, with us today to talk about the latest study looking at alcohol-related deaths among working-age Americans. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you changed the way you drink or whether you drink over time? How did it work for you? How has alcohol affected the health, your health in your family? Call in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Brian is with us in Madison. Brian, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I was just wondering if there is any data correlating income level with drinking, whether it's the risky drinking or just those long-term health effects. I know when I was in my young 20s, we couldn't afford to go out snowboarding or on a road trip, but we could split a 24-rack of PBR, and that's a good enough weekend. So I was just wondering if this affects people at lower incomes at higher rates.
Brian, thanks for the call. Dr. Remington, I know there are efforts to break things down demographically. Do we know if there's any link between income level and problem drinking or alcohol-induced mortality?
Well, again, this study did not look at that specifically. They looked more at the regional variation, and we see tremendous differences from state to state. Culture is a very big driver in alcohol use patterns and misuse patterns. And so that differs across all socioeconomic levels. And then the second thing is that the different causes of death are very different in different socioeconomic groups. For example, alcoholism and alcohol abuse is higher in people with who earn less money. Sometimes even the alcohol causes one to lose a job, and it's a spiral effect. But the binge drinking that you see, for example, drinking and driving, or even moderate heavy drinking, is not so strongly tied with economics. So it really requires you to tease out the specific causes of death and health problems, and so there isn't the association that you might see with cigarette smoking, for example, where rates of cigarette smoking are much higher in people with less education and people who are earning less. That alcohol related problems are less clearly related to those social economic factors.
Brian, thanks for that call and that question at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Lydia in Eau Claire. Lydia, what's on your mind?
Well, I'm interested in the idea of broadening, having people more aware that there are strategies to alcohol abuse beyond AA, because of course AA has done wonderful things for millions of people, but it also does not resonate with a lot of people who do have alcohol use disorder. And it's about curiosity around the whys of drinking and developing self-compassion. And of course, AA's peer group model, peer model, and sponsorship models to our genius, but I'm just saying that broader options besides AA.
Lydia, I got you. Thanks a lot for the call. Dr. Remington, is there a range of options for treatment, especially as Lydia was talking about, for people who would be seen as problem alcoholics?
Well, it's a great question. And as a preventive medicine physician, I truly believe that we should begin earlier, not just at younger ages, but earlier in problem drinking, that there are programs that are effective once somebody is affected by alcoholism and heavy drinking, but we have much more effective approaches that involve asking patients about their alcohol consumption and then giving brief advice about what might become a problem later on. So that brief counseling, how much are you drinking? Well, I hear you're drinking 2 drinks a day, every day. You know, that's a moderate level, and that pattern could lead to health problems down the road. It's much easier to intervene earlier in one's life and before problem drinking begins. So I couldn't agree more with the caller. We have to rely on those effective programs once people have suffered the consequences and become addicted or alcoholic, but it is much more effective to work earlier in the life and earlier in the problem drinking continuum.
Lydia, thanks a lot for that call. Dr. Remington, that kind of screening you just mentioned, screening and advice, is that common? Is that universal in doctor's appointments? Where are we with that?
Well, it's a great question. The research has been done. It's convincing. It's called screening and brief interventions and referral. So simply asking the question isn't good enough. But the evidence is very much there that if a physician or a healthcare provider asks you the question, has the conversation, that people open up and are often surprised to hear that even moderate drinking can lead to health problems. And then you refer to programs that can help people modify their drinking behaviors. Unfortunately, our healthcare system is not aligned as well as it could be to promote those effective preventive services. They don't get compensated very well. Health visits tend to be problem-oriented as opposed to prevention-oriented. So yes, they're effective. Some health systems implement them, but I think there's a lot more opportunity for doing that. Because again, prevention is the best medicine. And if we can intervene by having that conversation earlier, the changes are much easier for individuals to make.
Lydia, thanks again for that call. Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington about new data out from the CDC on alcohol-related deaths in the United States. Dr. Remington, you mentioned that they broke it down by region, and we can look at states from this report and, of course, from research you've done. What do we know about Wisconsin in particular?
It's a very interesting question, Rob. I immediately assumed Wisconsin would lead the list on deaths related to alcohol, but was surprised to see we are in about the middle. And then I recalled that we actually did a study about 20 years ago where, despite Wisconsin leading the nation in rates of drinking and binge drinking, we don't lead the nation in cirrhosis deaths. And what that means is that most likely in Wisconsin, we have a lot of people, a lot more people who drink, but we don't have, there's no evidence that I've seen of a higher rate of people who have problem drinking and diseases related to alcohol abuse and misuse. So that we have a high rate of participation in drinking, but many people drink light drinkers or moderate drinkers. So we don't certainly lead the list states that are seeing this. States like New Mexico, Alaska, Wyoming, those states have a much higher alcohol-related death rate than we do here in Wisconsin. Not that there isn't opportunity to improve. We certainly can reduce the alcohol-related deaths in our state, but we don't lead the nation in that measure.
And you've talked about a couple of the ways we can help reduce those numbers in Wisconsin or anywhere. How about culture and community and how we talk about drinking, how we drink, how we take care of each other when we're drinking to avoid those acute incidents, whether it's a car crash or a fall? Do you see room for improvement in Wisconsin on those measures?
Well, we know that one approach, prohibition, does not work. So I think any attempt to prohibit alcohol use is not going to be effective. I think certainly education early on about what is problem drinking, the difference between light and moderate drinking, heavy long-term drinking, and then acute alcohol use like binge drinking. So I think having conversations with your family members, your peers, but also the healthcare system does play a really important role in providing this kind of advice. Again, many people that I talk to don't realize that breast cancer, colon cancer, very common cancers that we certainly all want to avoid, are related to alcohol use. So when you look at a report like this, it is surprising how many chronic diseases, heart disease, stroke, liver disease, but also a number of cancers are related to moderate and heavy alcohol use. So I think that information alone can persuade some people. And then we have to come in with policies that have been shown to reduce alcohol use in addition to simply public education.
Dr. Remington, as always, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Population Health Sciences at UW-Madison and Director of the UW-Madison Preventive Medicine Residency Program. He joins us to talk about a new CDC study that shows 1 in 8 deaths among working-age Americans are alcohol-related. If you or someone you know needs help with alcohol abuse or addiction, you can contact 800-662-HELP. That's 800-662-4357. With the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration for referral and information services. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, find out why art can make a big difference in schools and not just in art or music classes. A guest makes the case that an art-inspired mindset can help kids learn all across the curriculum. And new words enter the English language all the time. Some of them even find their way into the dictionary after a while. Check out some of the newest words in the official English language, where they come from, what inspires them, and what helps some of them stand the test of time. And you can always follow us at WPR.org. Check out live streams and archives. That and more coming up tomorrow afternoon here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, how often do you set aside time to do things by yourself? Our guest says there's a lot to gain from going out in public alone, and we should do it more often. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll take a look at a U.S. Supreme Court case that could give state legislatures virtually unchecked power in making rules for federal elections. First, if you've been thinking about checking out that new local restaurant or catching a movie in the theater, you might also ask yourself who to go with. And the best answer might be yourself. Our next guest found a lot of value in going on a regular self-date and has written about the benefits of doing things in public by ourselves and embracing solitude. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you do this? Do you set aside time to go out and do things alone? Where do you like to go by yourself? Do you feel weird, as I do, maybe eating at a restaurant by yourself? Nobody's judging you, but does it feel weird? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Faith Hill is a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. She's been writing about the value of solitude in a few pieces lately. Her latest is called Take Yourself on a Date. Faith, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you've been kind of been on the solitude beat lately. The piece I just mentioned, you wrote about the value of time alone for kids, about people who are nocturnal because they enjoy being by themselves. What got you interested in why people choose to spend time alone?
Yeah, well, I really love my time alone, and socializing can really drain me. But at the same time, I feel like my relationships are extremely important to me. I want to tend to them. I care about them. So just personally, the balance between solitude and social connection is something I think about a lot. I'm sort of always looking for this perfect in-between. And I think for a lot of people, it's complicated. It's hard to figure out how much alone time you should carve out for yourself, particularly because I think alone time isn't really valued like social time is. So, you know, you hear a lot about the need for connection and community, but I was sort of interested in the flip side to that.
And off the top, I want to distinguish between loneliness and solitude. Could you spell out the difference there a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, a lot of times people sort of think of the difference in terms of quantity, that, you know, you want some time alone, but not too much, and when you have too much, it's loneliness. And there's some truth to that. You know, I think different people need different amounts of alone time, but you don't probably want to have too much. But another thing that matters is quality. So a lot of it is really in sort of how you're looking at your alone time, how you're approaching it, and sort of, you know, the attitude that you come at it with. So I think for a lot of people, even if they didn't choose to have alone time, it can really help to sort of think of it as an opportunity.
And the intentionality is something that you are really focused on, I think, as opposed to, oh, I got, you know, an hour or two by myself. What am I going to do? Read a book, this or that. You really want this to be premeditated. And that's something you've been working on yourself. Why is that important?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for a long time, I, you know, even though I thought of myself as someone who liked alone time, I did not think of like doing an activity with it or making it any kind of special ritual. It was just sort of when I was able to get it, pockets in between things. But, you know, I think that you sort of look at your alone time differently if you make a ritual out of it. And a lot of times we don't think about solitude that way. You know, we think of it either as like a productive time or just empty time. But we don't think of it as like the time that we reserve for fun things. So I kind of wanted to focus on just like that ability to really do whatever you would want to do, but do it by yourself. And that can include, you know, being in public, being in the world, doing what you love.
And that's what you've chosen to do with a lot of your intentional, your planned solitude is do things in public. Why is that important to you to be going out and doing a museum or a dinner or whatever it might be?
Yeah, I think there's something special about being alone around other people and just in the world, you know, maybe experiencing art or food, smelling smells and hearing music and voices. It sort of makes you remember that you're like, you know, you don't exist outside of the world. You're sort of part of this vast symphony of human experience. But at the same time, you know, you still get to sort of listen to your own thoughts and you don't have to always be responding to someone else. I think, you know, when you're socializing, you don't always even fully appreciate the sort of like sensory experience going on around you, ironically enough, because you're sort of wrapped up in conversation or discussing what to do next. So it can actually be a way to really connect with the world and be sort of present in space and, you know, seeing people and listening.
That sounds cool. But I'm also, as you're talking, I'm thinking there's almost like a cliche scene in movies and TV shows where our protagonist shows up at the restaurant by themselves and the maitre d' or waiter or whatever is like, will sir be dining alone today, with a bit of pity. And it's like this sad sort of pathetic thing. How do we overcome that mindset?
It's a good question. I think in America, at least, we really value extroversion and social connection. And, you know, there's research about how people sort of assume that if they're out doing something enjoyable in public, like they assume people will think that they are lonely or friendless. But, you know, some of that research also shows that like people overestimate the degree to which they'll seem lonely. So I think, you know, partly it's real, but partly it's in our heads and we kind of let ourselves worry about it too much. And I think probably if you go out and do something, you might be, you know, surprised if you knew what people were thinking about, that they're more concerned about themselves. But I also think there's sort of different levels to it. So, you know, I can totally understand being nervous to go to a crowded restaurant by yourself. And I think it's awesome if people do, but you don't need to do any one thing. So I kind of liked going to movies alone for that reason, because I get to sort of be, you know, around strangers, but also like in the dark and I don't feel so in the spotlight. So, you know, I think part of the beauty of the self-date is really you choosing what you want to do. And there's a lot of different options. You know, you could go for a walk, you could be in the park, and some of them might feel a little bit more comfortable.
Talking to Faith Hill, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic, about the value of solitude and going out and doing things on our own and making a plan, being intentional about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you do some version of this? Say, I'm going to plan for some time to go out and do what? Tell us about it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Ellen is with us in Wausau. Ellen, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
So my comment is that I don't mind eating out by myself. in a restaurant, and I often enjoy it. But 9 times out of 10, when I walk in and say table for one, the response I get is just one.
Oh, no. Well, do you find a different restaurant the next time then, Ellen?
I have stopped going to restaurants who give me really lousy tables, like a table back by the bathroom.
Oh, but you don't mind, you like it's them that are creating the problem here. Once you're there, you're fine eating by yourself.
Yes, definitely. But I get a negative response when people say just one.
Oh no. All right. Well, Ellen, well, if you've served Ellen in that way, cut it out. Be nice to Ellen when she shows up at your restaurant. Faith, there it is. I mean, I'll say when I'm at a restaurant eating by myself, I feel weird about it. If I see somebody else eating by themselves, I don't even think about it. Why? I don't know. Why do some people anyway feel like we're judged or judging someone eating by themselves like Ellen?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I do think, you know, there's can kind of be a mismatch there between how weird we feel and how we view other people. But I think it's a good point, too, that it is partly like a bigger structural problem that, you know, we look at aloneness in this way. And it's, you know, easier said than done to just be like, go eat at a restaurant alone. Like some people are, you know, might make you feel weird about it. But in case it helps, one thing that I have found is really helpful is if I take a book, I feel like I can always have it in case I want to pull it out if I'm feeling weird, but I'm still, you know, having my own solo experience.
I have used the book shield before myself. Ellen, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Faith Hill, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic, about the upside of doing things alone. Her latest piece is called Take Yourself on a Date. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you do this sort of thing? Take yourself out to dinner, movie, museum, hike, whatever. Does it feel weird when people see you doing something alone, or does it not? Do you not care what people think, even if they do look at you funny? Call 800-642-1234. Do you find a lot of value in solitude? Or, I don't know, does being up in your own head sometimes get a little much? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Faith Hill from The Atlantic, talking about why it can be good to do things by yourself out in public. Make time to do some solitary activities. We can get a lot out of it, she says. Join in at 800-642-1234. If you have examples of this kind of thing in your own life, 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go back to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon. Happy holidays. This is a fun topic for me. I vacation by myself. I get excited because I always meet new people when I go wherever I go. But I have a New Yorker cartoon idea on this topic.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, if you put a sweet potato on a park bench, the caption would read, I am what I am.
Jeff, thanks a lot. A vacation by himself of Faith. That's taking this even a step further.
Yes, it is. But apparently it's, you know, a lot of people feel the same. Rates of solo travel are way up, and a lot of people are doing it in 2022, which I think is great. And for my piece, I did talk to a travel coach who sort of, you know, told me that she has really been seeing this firsthand. And from talking to some of her clients, they've really been starting to feel like, you know, maybe they don't need to wait around for other people to take that trip they really want to take. So, you know, fingers crossed, maybe people are getting more comfortable with doing things by themselves. But I think solo travel is a really cool way of looking at that. So much you can experience, and so many people who are like dying to go places, but trying to coordinate with someone else. So it's great.
Jeff, happy solo travels. Kurt joins us now in Elgin, Illinois. Kurt, hi.
Yeah, hi. I was piggyback on what was just said, but I had something else to say. I've just retired, and I'm very much looking forward to, I've learned to look forward to, trips that I would take by myself to all those places I would go to with other people. And I'm looking forward to that. And what I mentioned is I'm very happy being with myself and by myself in places, but I feel sad, I'll have to say, when I see other people who are just sitting by themselves, kind of like that Nighthawks, when you look at the whoever Edward Hopper's Nighthawks thing,
sure,
looking through that window. I feel sad about that, but I never feel that same for myself. I feel like I almost feel like I want to get into that mode when I can just be
myself. Kurt, thank you so much for sharing that. Now, you, Faith, talked to a psychologist about that. There can be better or worse ways to be in our heads when we're doing this solitude stuff. What did you learn?
Yeah, it's so true. So I talked to this psychologist, Ethan Cross, about this. He wrote a book called Chatter, and it's about this kind of self-talk, as it's called. It's basically the internal conversation going on in your head. And he has found that self-talk can really help with introspection, but you have to do it in the right way, or else you can really sort of go down a rabbit hole of rumination. You know, one thing that can help with that is shifting the perspective that you use to talk to yourself. So literally, like, using the second or third person rather than the first. And instead of saying, you know, I should do something, you'd say you should, or, you know, she should. So the idea is that because you're usually nicer to other people than to yourself, you're kind of treating yourself as another person. So, you know, it might sound silly, but I think when you're out alone by yourself, it can be useful to think of it as sort of a similar principle where, you know, you're not just doing something yourself, but you're really taking yourself out to do something. You know, it's almost chivalrous and you're sort of getting to know yourself. So it's so true that there are sort of better and worse ways, and some people can sort of feel lonely if they are, like, very much, you know, wrapped up in their own head and feeling like just stuck within that rather than kind of in the world, and having that distance.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Sue with us in Appleton. Sue, hi, what did you want to tell us about?
Hi, I wanted to talk about traveling and negotiating the world as a single woman. I go camping alone, long distance camping. I put on over 10,000 miles last year, and
wow,
I'll be leaving in January to do it again. And I'm a member of lots of women camper groups, and we discuss safety a lot, that we don't, some of us don't want our van to be, or our vehicles, campers, to be identified as a woman is in there. So there are various techniques and tips that women use to, as decoys, so people might think there's a second person or a man with us when we're camping. But there are a lot of women doing this who are not necessarily single. We just love that we don't have to negotiate where we'll go, when we'll go, should we stop, should we change directions. It's just so much freedom. Just love it.
Sue, thank you so much for sharing the joys of it and the safety concerns. Faith, what do you think about Sue's experience?
Yeah, it's a really, really good point. And I think it's so true that, you know, some people really have to think about safety when they're thinking about being alone. And there are limits to, you know, just doing whatever you want to do out by yourself. But I love the idea of kind of doing it as a group, but still, you know, I think there are still chances for solitude within that. That's such a good point. And when I talked to that travel coach, she mentioned that she will sometimes talk to clients who are worried either about safety or just, you know, getting lonely, wanting to make sure they'll have the opportunity to be around people if they want to, even though they do want time to themselves. And she recommends walking groups. So it's sort of a similar idea of, like, you know, you don't necessarily need to be talking all the time. It might be different than, like, going just with a partner or best friend. You're really expected to sort of be chatting constantly, or, you know, just really spending your time together, but you can kind of be with people, but, you know, then also be in your head when you want to be. And I think that is sort of it's a beautiful part about that kind of solo travel and the self-date, is that you know, you have some control over that and you can kind of get both.
Thanks a lot for that call. Michael joins us now in Kaukauna. Michael, hello.
Oh, I just have been a field service technician for a big part of my career, and that involves being away from home and kind of into a forced doing things by your own. You kind of just learn to get used to it, and you learn to kind of enjoy it. One of the little tricks that I would always do is I would eat places where you could eat at the bar, because then you wouldn't be taking up a whole table. for our group, and then people are more open to that. So that's just one of the things I learned. You just kind of learn to roll with it. You have to enjoy it and look at the different tips you can to make it easier for the staff for the restaurant that you're at.
Michael, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Faith, Michael didn't necessarily choose to be alone. The job put him there, but he made the most of it.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring this up because it really is, you know, it's kind of a documented thing that I talked to some researchers about when I was writing this piece is that, you know, I sort of suspected, like thinking about pandemic isolation, like that if people were forced into some alone time, they would automatically not like it because they didn't feel they'd chosen it. But what I learned is actually that even, you know, when some people sort of found themselves having to be alone, it still sort of mattered how they, you know, then looked at the alone time. And there, you know, were a lot of people who I think found, you know, even through all the many difficult parts that they liked some of that solitude more than they thought they would. So it really can change everything, sort of how you think about the alone time, even if it's, you know, you kind of find yourself with it.
Thanks a lot for that call. Faith, I wanted to take a couple minutes on another piece you wrote about kids and solitude. And, you know, we often hear about overscheduling, overbooking kids. How important is some alone time, some solitude for kids?
Yeah, it can be really important. You know, of course, kids, like, you know, most people, it's good to have some socializing. So it's not that they should, you know, have too much alone time. But I think people really don't think about kids needing any alone time at all. And it turns out there's some really important psychological benefits. You know, younger kids can kind of learn how to work out big emotions. Teenagers certainly use it for sort of reflection and thinking about their identity and who they are apart from their family unit and their friends. So I think it is really important for, you know, parents to sort of keep that in mind and ask their kid whether they, you know, feel like they have enough alone time or, you know, they might want to cut back activities.
Now, getting back to the grownups here, Faith, suppose somebody's listening and thinking, okay, yeah, this sounds pretty good. And I never do this sort of thing, like never make a plan to take myself out and do whatever. Can you offer some encouragement, maybe some first steps for them to give it a shot?
Yeah. So, you know, I think the sort of crucial part of the self-date is that it is whatever you want it to be. So you shouldn't feel like, you know, you have to go out for 3 hours and eat at a restaurant alone. It's, you know, like the whole point of it is that it's tailored to you and what you want to do. So you can really, you know, dip your toe in. You could do something alone at home, but, you know, really make it feel special and sort of set that time aside and think of it as an opportunity that you want to celebrate. Or, you know, you could go out for a little bit and, you know, make it a shorter trip or always let yourself come home. You know, one researcher told me there are sort of like different rooms of solitude that you can enjoy. And, you know, one room might be total solitude and the other might be sort of a little bit of solitude, but you're around people and they can all serve different purposes. So I would just say it's, you know, maybe not useful always to be like a solitude purist. You know, it's really important, but it also is, you know, it's different for different people.
Faith, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Faith Hill, Associate Senior Editor at The Atlantic. We talked to her about the benefits of doing things by ourselves and her latest piece called Take Yourself on a Date. You can find a link to that at WPR.org/Central Time. And if you do this, if you take yourself on a date, if you enjoy those planned moments or hours of solitude doing whatever it is you want to do, love to hear about it. You can tell us about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up after the news, a case before the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday could lead to big changes in elections around the country. We'll look at the independent legislature theory and possible limits on state courts and constitutions when it comes to elections. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.